This is a reading of the Agriculture course by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 4, given in Kobervitz on Thursday, June 12, 1924. We have seen that in order to arrive at spiritual scientific methods applicable to agriculture, we need to look at nature and the Spirit's activity in nature, in its entirety, in its most encompassing dimensions. Materialistic scientists, on the other hand, have increasingly tended to narrow their scope and investigate ever more minute entities, although at least with agriculture they haven't immediately gotten down to the microscopic level, which is so often the focus in other scientific disciplines. Even in agriculture, however, they still tend to be concerned with very small spheres of activity and the conclusions that can be drawn from them. But it is impossible to assess the world of human beings and other living beings solely from such narrow perspectives. The way current science deals with the realities of agriculture is equivalent to trying to reconstruct the totality of a human being from just a little finger and an earlobe. Today there is an absolutely urgent need to counteract this tendency with a genuine science that can encompass the large-scale cosmic interrelationships. Just think of how often current science, or the science of a few years ago, has had to correct itself. Take, for example, the scientific absurdities that were prevalent not too long ago regarding human nutrition. Everything was highly scientific and scientifically proven, and from a certain perspective the proofs were irrefutable. It was scientifically proven that an average person weighing 70 to 75 kilograms, 155 to 165 pounds, required about 120 grams, 4.5 ounces, of protein a day for adequate nutrition. As I said, this was scientifically proven. Yet today no scientifically inclined person believes this anymore. Science has corrected itself. Today everyone knows that 120 grams of protein per day are not only not necessary, but downright harmful, and that people will be healthiest if they consume no more than 50 grams, 1¾ ounces a day. Here, science has corrected itself. Today we know that excessive protein consumption creates byproducts in the intestines that are in fact toxic. And if you consider people's entire lifetime, and not just the period of life when the protein is being eaten, you will find that arterial sclerosis in old age is primarily due to the toxic effects of this excess protein. This is an example of how scientific investigations involving human subjects are often flawed, because they consider only the short-term effects. A normal human lifespan, however, is much longer than 10 years, and although initial results may seem favorable, detrimental effects often become evident much later on. Spiritual science is less likely to fall into errors like these. It is certainly not my intention to join in the cheap criticism that is often leveled at current science, because it has had to correct itself, as I described. Such things cannot always be helped. But on the other hand, it is just as cheap to criticize spiritual science when it enters into practical life and is obliged, for once, to consider life's larger relationships and to investigate not just the forces and substances that are crudely material, but also those that are more spiritual. This certainly applies to agriculture, and to the issue of fertilizers in particular. Even the way the scientists phrase their statements about fertilizing shows that they don't have any idea of its significance in the household of nature. Today we often hear the phrase, "Fertilizers contain the nutrients for the plants." Well, I deliberately said what I did just now about human nutrition, in order to show how even in very recent times science has had to correct itself. It has had to correct itself because it starts from a totally false view of how living things are nourished. People have believed that the most important factor in nutrition, please don't take it amiss if I speak quite freely now, is what we put into our mouths and eat. Certainly, what we eat is important, but most of what we consume on a daily basis is not there to be absorbed into the body and deposited as substance. It is there in order to convey its forces to the body, to rouse the body to activity. most of what we consume is actually excreted again, so that with regard to metabolism, the important thing is not so much the correct weights and proportions, but whether or not the vitality of the forces in the food can be taken up in the right way. We need this vitality, for instance, whenever we walk or work or simply move our arms. On the other hand, what our body uses in order to have deposits of substance, in order to enrich itself with substances, which are then again expelled as the body renews its substance every 7 or 8 years, most of this is taken up through the sensory organs, through the skin, through respiration. What the body takes in and deposits as substance is continually being absorbed in extremely fine doses. It only becomes condensed once it is inside the body. The body absorbs it from the air, and then hardens and condenses it to the point where we eventually cut it off in the form of nails, hair, and so forth. It's completely wrong to hold to the formula, ingestion of food, passage through the body, sloughing off of hair, nails, skin, etc. It should actually be breathing and refined uptake through the sensory organs, even the eyes, passage through the organism, sloughing off. On the other hand, what we take in through our stomach is important because it has inner energy like a fuel, because it brings in the forces that enable the will to be active in the body. This is the truth, the simple result of spiritual research. And it can drive one to despair to see modern science defending exactly the opposite point of view. I say this because when it comes to the most important questions, it is so very difficult to come to any kind of understanding with this modern science. And yet we must come to terms with it. If we don't, today's science will soon come to a complete dead end as far as practical matters are concerned, since its own methods prevent it from understanding some things that are right under its nose. I am not talking about experiments. As a rule, what science says about experiments is true, and they're very useful. It is the theorizing after the fact that's so bad, for out of this theorizing come the practical guidelines in many different fields of activity. Given all this, you can see how difficult it is to come to any kind of understanding. But on the other hand, such understanding must come, especially in the most practical areas of life, which include agriculture. You see, if we want to manage things properly in the various domains of agriculture, it is certainly necessary to have insight into the way substances and forces work, and also into the way the spirit works. Just as a small child who does not yet understand the purpose of a comb may chew on it or misuse it in some other way, so too will we misuse things if we do not understand their central nature. To understand what I mean, let us begin by considering a tree. A tree is different from an ordinary annual plant that never gets past the herbaceous stage. A tree surrounds itself with bark, and so on. But what is the essential nature of a tree in contrast to an annual plant? Let us compare the tree with a mound of soil that is unusually rich in humus, that contains an unusual amount of plant matter in the process of decomposition, and perhaps some decomposing animal products, too. Here on the left is the mound of humus-rich soil, in which I have made a crater-shaped depression. On the right is the tree, which is more or less solid on the outside, and which on the inside is growing and creating its shape. I am sure it seems strange to you that I have drawn these two things side by side, but they are actually much more closely related than you might think. Soil that is permeated with humus-like substances in the process of decomposition actually contains living ether, and that is what is important. When such soil shows us, by virtue of its particular structure and character, that it contains something etheric and alive, this means it is on the way to becoming a kind of plant sheathing. It just doesn't go as far as to become the kind of sheathing that draws itself into the bark of a tree. As you can imagine, it can't go that far in nature. But the fact is that instead of having a mound that incorporates the special etheric qualities characteristic of humus, at a higher stage of evolution, the mound simply wraps itself around the plant. For any given locality on Earth, there is a certain level that separates what is above the earth from what is inside the earth. Anything raised up above the normal level for that locale will show a particular tendency to life, a tendency to become permeated with etheric vitality. You will therefore find it easier to permeate ordinary inorganic soil with humus-like material or any other kind of refuse in the process of decomposition if you first build up the soil into mounds. Then, of its own accord, the soil will tend to become inwardly alive and plant-like. The same process occurs in the formation of a tree. The soil mounds itself up and surrounds the plant. It envelops the tree with its etheric vitality. You see, I am telling you all this so that you will begin to comprehend that there is an intimate relationship between what is within the contours of a plant and the soil surrounding the plant. It is not at all true that life stops at the plant's perimeter. Life as such continues on, namely, from the roots of the plant into the soil, and for many plants there is no sharp dividing line between the life inside them and the life in their surroundings. We must be imbued with this idea and understand it thoroughly in order to understand the nature of soil that has been manured or otherwise fertilized in some way. We must recognize that fertilizing must consist of enlivening the soil so that the plant is not in dead soil and does not have difficulty making it through to the fruiting stage out of its own vitality. The plant does this more easily if, from the very beginning, it is embedded in something living. Basically, all plant growth has a slightly parasitic quality because it grows out of the living soil like a parasite. This has to be that way. In many regions of the world, we have to help out the plants by fertilizing, because we cannot count on nature itself to incorporate enough organic residues into the soil and break them down far enough so that the soil becomes sufficiently enlivened. This is least necessary in the regions where there is so-called black earth. There, nature itself sees to it that the soil is sufficiently alive. So you see that we must really understand what fertilizing is all about. But now there is also something else we must understand, and that is how to establish a kind of personal relationship to everything in farming, especially to the various manures, to the methods of working with them. This may seem unpleasant, but without the personal relationship it really won't work. And why not? Well, this will soon become evident to you if you consider the fact that living things always have an inside and an outside. The inside is enclosed within a skin of some kind, and the outside is outside of that skin. Let us now consider the inside. The inside of something living not only has forces that stream outward in the direction of these arrows drawing nine, but also forces that stream inward that are turned back. In addition, it is surrounded by all kinds of forces on the outside. Now, there is something that expresses very exactly, if rather personally, how something living establishes a balance between its inside and its outside. All the forces working to stimulate and maintain life within this living organism, within the contours of its skin, have to smell. You could also say they have to stink. This is basically what it means to be alive. That the things that would spread odors around if they were released are held together, that they do not stream outward too strongly, but are held together inside and smell there. An organism lives in such a way that it allows as little as possible of the odor generated by the life within it to slip past the boundary of its skin. You might say that the healthier an organism is, the more it smells on the inside, and the less it smells on the outside. An organism, that is to say a plant organism, is not predestined to give off odors, but rather to absorb them. And if we comprehend the beneficial effects of an aromatic meadow full of fragrant plants, we will realize the kind of mutual support that takes place among living things. The fragrance that spreads around out there is what works on the plant from inside. It is different than the mere life scent, and spreads around for reasons that we will still come to. We must have a personal relationship to all these things. Then we will truly participate in nature. It is important to comprehend that manuring and similar practices must consist in providing the soil with a certain degree of vitality. But in addition to this, they must also allow the soil to develop the process I called special attention to yesterday. The nitrogen must be able to spread out in the soil in such a way that life is guided toward certain lines of force, as I illustrated for you. Thus, when we fertilize, we must bring sufficient nitrogen to the earth realm so that in the fields where plants are to be grown, life can be brought to those structures in the earth realm that need it. That is the task, and it must be carried out in a sober and exact manner. Now, this could already lead us to suspect that when you use pure minerals as fertilizer, you can never really influence the earthy element in the soil, but only, at most, the watery element. By using mineral fertilizers, you can influence the soil's watery element to some degree, but you will never really be able to enliven the earthy element itself. Plants that have been treated with any kind of mineral fertilizer will show, by their growth, that they have been sustained only by stimulated water and not by enlivened earthiness. If we want to understand these things, we would do best to turn first to the least pretentious type of fertilizer, namely compost, which is sometimes even treated with disdain. In compost, we have a means for enlivening the soil. And compost can include any kind of organic waste from the farm or garden. Spoiled hay, fallen leaves, even dead animals. We should not turn up our noses at things like this, since they still contain valuable etheric forces, and also astral forces. These forces are not as strong as those in solid manure or liquid manure, but in a certain sense they are more stable. The astrality is, in particular, is more stable. It is simply a matter of allowing for this stability in the right way. If the etheric life in a compost pile is too rampant, the ability of the astrality to influence the nitrogen is immediately impaired. The astrality is prevented from coming into its own, so to speak. There is a particular substance, however, namely lime, whose favorable influence in the natural world I have already described from several different points of view. If you add some lime to the compost pile, perhaps in the form of quicklime, a remarkable thing happens. Without causing the astrality to volatilize too strongly, the quicklime takes up the etheric, and with it also the oxygen, so that the astrality becomes effective in a wonderful way. This accomplishes something very specific. When you use this compost as fertilizer, you will be giving the soil's earthy component something that strongly permeates it with astrality, without the detour of the etheric. Just picture it. The astrality penetrates very strongly into the earthy component of the soil, without first going by way of the etheric, so that the soil becomes strongly astralized, and by means of what is astralized becomes permeated with nitrogenous substance. What arises there is really very similar to a certain plant-like process in the human organism, a plant-like process that is not concerned with reaching the fruiting stage, but which is content to remain, as it were, at the stage of leaf and stem formation. The process we impart to the soil must also exist in us, so that in a corresponding way we can bring our food to the necessary energetic state that I mentioned earlier. When we treat the soil in the way I have described, we stimulate it to the most energetic state. And this prepares the soil to bring forth something that is especially good for animals to consume, so that under its influence they can develop inner liveliness, so that their bodies can become inwardly energetic. In other words, we would do well to fertilize our pastures and meadows with this compost. If we do this conscientiously, that is, if we also carry out the other procedures that are necessary, we will end up with good pasturage, which, even when it is cut, will make good hay. I would like to say, however, that in order to proceed in the right way with things like this, we need to have insight into the whole matter. What we do in particular instances will naturally depend on our feeling, but this feeling develops itself once we have proper insight into the whole nature of the process. Now, if you simply leave a compost pile lying around as I have described it so far, it can very easily begin to scatter its astrality. It is at this point that the personal relationship you develop to these things becomes important, because you need to do whatever you can to make the pile smell as little as possible. This can be easily accomplished if you build up the pile in thin layers and cover each layer with something like loose peat before adding the next one. This holds together what would otherwise escape in the form of odors, that is to say, the nitrogen, which wants to escape in all kinds of guises and combinations. The main thing I want to indicate here is that we must approach everything in farming with the conviction that in order for the whole thing to work, we need to pour life and also astrality into everything around us. Now, if we continue from here, something else may occur to you. Have you ever thought about why cows have horns, but certain other animals have antlers? That's an extremely important question. However, what science has to offer on this point is usually very one-sided and superficial. Let us try to answer this question of why cows have horns. Remember that I said that something living need not have forces that only stream outward. It can also have forces that stream inward. Imagine here some organic entity with streams of force going in both directions. If that were all there was to it, we would have a rather irregular, lumpy creature. A cow would look very peculiar. Its limbs would stay tiny, the way they are in the earliest embryonic stages. It would simply look grotesque. But that's not how a cow is put together. A cow has horns and also hoofs. What happens at the places where the horns and hoofs grow? At these places, the streams are especially strongly turned back inward, and the outside is particularly strongly shut off. All outward communication, such as can occur through skin or hair, is completely ruled out. In this way, the development of the horns and hoofs is connected to the form and development of the animal as a whole. Antler formation is something totally different. In the case of antlers, the streams are not directed back into the organism. Instead, the antlers serve as outlets so that certain streams can be led outward for a ways and discharged there. Parenthesis, streams don't always have to be fluid or gaseous. They can also be streams of force, which in this case are localized in the antlers. End parenthesis. A stag is beautiful because it stands in intense communication with its surroundings, because it directs some of its force streams outward and lives at one with its environment, and thereby takes in everything that influences the nerves and senses on an organic level. A stag thus becomes a quick and nervous animal. In a certain respect, all animals with antlers are suffused with a slight nervousness, which can already be seen in their eyes. A cow has horns in order to send the formative astroletheric forces back into its digestive system, so that much work can be accomplished there by means of these radiations from the horns and hoofs. Anyone trying to understand foot and mouth disease, that is, how the periphery of the animal works back on the digestive tract, needs to understand this relationship. Our remedy for foot and mouth disease is based on insight into this relationship. So you see, there is something inherent in a horn that makes it well suited for reflecting living and astral influences back into the activity of the interior. In a horn, you have something that can radiate life and even astrality. It is truly so. If you could crawl around inside the living body of a cow, if you were right inside the cow's belly, you would be able to smell how living astrality streams inward from the horns. And with the hoofs, it is similar. This all points to measures we might introduce to enhance the effectiveness of ordinary barn manure. What is this manure in reality? It is outer nourishment that has entered into the animal, that has been absorbed to some extent, and given occasion for the dynamic development of forces within the organism, but which has then been excreted, rather than serving primarily to enrich the animal with substance. In passing through the organism, however, it has become pervaded with astral and etheric activity. It has become permeated with nitrogen-bearing forces and oxygen-bearing forces. The mass that emerges as manure is impregnated with all this. Now suppose we take this mass in some form or other, we'll go into details later, and give it over to the earth. What we would actually be doing is putting something etheric and astral into the earth, something that by rights belongs in the belly of an animal, and in the belly produces plant-like forces. Indeed, the forces that are engendered in our digestive tract are plant-like. We ought, actually, to be terribly grateful that there is anything left over as manure, because in this way something etheric and astral is carried from inside the organs out into the open. These etheric and astral forces are inherent in the manure. All we have to do is to preserve them, so that they can have an enlivening and astralizing effect on the soil, and not only on the watery part of the soil, but also on the earthy mineral component. Manure has sufficient force to overcome even the inorganic earth element. Now, what we put into the ground, of course, must lose the form it originally had before it was consumed as fodder. It must have gone through an internal organic process in the animal's metabolic system. To a certain extent, it will already have begun to decay and dissolve, but it is best if it has just reached the point where it's beginning to fall apart by virtue of its own etheric and astral forces. Then microscopic parasites, the smallest living creatures, put in an appearance and find a fertile breeding ground in the manure. This is why people think these parasitic beings have something to do with the manure's quality. In actuality, however, they are only a sign that the manure is already in a certain condition. They can be useful as indicators, but we are succumbing to an illusion if we think we can radically improve manure by inoculating it with bacteria and so on. It might initially appear to do so, but in reality that's not the case. I will return to this later. Meanwhile, let's continue. Now, let us take the manure, in whatever form is available, stuff it into a cow horn, and bury it in the ground at a certain depth, I would say between 3/4 and 1.5 meters, that is 2.5 to 5 feet, provided the soil beneath is neither too clayey nor too sandy. We should select a good soil that's not too sandy. You see, by burying the cow horn with the manure in it, we preserve in the horn the etheric and astral forces that the horn was accustomed to reflect when it was on the cow. Because the cow horn is now outwardly surrounded by the earth, all the earth's etherizing and astralizing rays stream into its inner cavity. The manure inside the horn attracts these forces and is inwardly enlivened by them. If the horn is buried for the entire winter, the season when the earth is most inwardly alive, all this life will be preserved in the manure, turning the contents of the horn into an extremely concentrated, enlivening, and fertilizing force. Once the winter is over, we can dig up the cow horn and take the manure out of it. During our last experiments in Dornach, people discovered that when we took the manure out, it did not stink at all anymore. This was very striking. It had no smell any more, although, of course, it did begin to smell a little as we mixed it with water. This shows that all the smell in it had been concentrated and transformed. After spending the winter underground, the cow horn contains an immense astral and etheric energy, which you can now use by diluting the contents with ordinary water, which should perhaps be warmed up a bit. I have always found, inasmuch as I first looked at the area to be treated, to get an impression of the quantities, that for an area as large as, say, from the third window here to the first footpath, that this needs only one hornful of manure, diluted in about half a bucket of water. You must make sure, however, that the entire contents of the horn have been thoroughly exposed to the water. To do this, you have to start stirring it quickly around the edge of the bucket, on the periphery, until a crater forms that reaches nearly to the bottom, so that everything is rotating rapidly. Then you reverse direction quickly, so that everything seethes and starts to swirl in the opposite direction. If you continue doing this for an hour, you will get it thoroughly mixed. Just imagine how little work this takes. The burden of labor for these things will not be very great. Besides, I could imagine that otherwise unoccupied members of a farming household might really enjoy stirring the manure, at least for a while. The sons and daughters of the household could do an excellent job of it. It is a very pleasant feeling to experience how a delicate odor develops out of what was initially odorless. The personal relationship that you can develop to such things is extremely beneficial for people who wish to experience nature as a whole, and not just as it appears in the Baedeker guidebooks. The next thing to do is to spray the substance over your plowed fields so that it can really unite with the soil. When only small areas are involved, you can apply it with an ordinary syringe sprayer, but of course for larger areas, special machines will need to be constructed. If you manage to supplement your usual manuring with this kind of spiritual manure, in quotes, you will soon see what fertility will result. In particular, you will find that these things lend themselves to further development in a most remarkable way. Thus, you can follow up the measure I've just explained with another one, which can be as follows. Once again, take cow horns, but this time, instead of stuffing them with manure, fill them with quartz that has been ground to a powder and mixed with water to the consistency of a very thin dough. Instead of quartz, you could also use orthoclase, feldspar. And now, instead of leaving the cow horn in the ground during the winter, let it stay underground all summer, and then take it out in late autumn. Save the contents until the next spring, and then take what was exposed to the summer life of the earth, and treat it just as you did the manure. In this case, however, you will need much smaller quantities. You can take a portion the size of a pea, or maybe no bigger than a pinhead, and stir it into a whole bucket of water. This too needs to be stirred for an hour. If you apply this as a fine spray on the plants themselves, especially on vegetables and things like that, you will soon notice how its effect complements and supports the influence coming from the other side, from the soil, as a result of the cow horn manure. And if you were also to extend this treatment to entire fields, it shouldn't be too difficult to construct machines that would apply the very light spraying we need, you would then see how the cow horn manure pushes from below and how the other stuff pulls from above, neither too strongly nor too gently. It could be wonderfully effective, especially in the case of grains. You see, these things are derived from a wider field of observation, and not just from dealing with the single thing in question, which is like trying to reconstruct a whole being from a single finger. Something is attained thereby, which is definitely not to be underestimated. The studies that are made nowadays, studies on farm productivity and the like, are really nothing more than studies on how to make production as profitable as possible. They don't amount to much more than that. Of course, even farmers are impressed, although they aren't always conscious of it, when some measure or other achieves big results, huge potatoes, for example, or anything else big and swollen. But then the investigation is not taken any further, even though these things are not the most important aspects at all. The most important thing is that once these things reach human beings, their effect on human life should be as beneficial and health-giving as possible. You can raise fruits that look magnificent in the orchard or field, but as far as human beings are concerned, they may simply be stomach filler and not promote human life. But today's science is unable to pursue things to the point where people would be getting the best kind of nourishment. It simply does not know how to go about it. In contrast, what spiritual science has to say on the subject is rooted in the whole household of nature. It is always conceived out of the totality. And for this reason, the individual measures are also decisive for the totality. If we farm like this, the result can be nothing other than what is best for human beings and also for animals. In spiritual science, human beings are our standard and our starting point. All our practical suggestions serve the purpose of sustaining the whole human being in the best way possible. That is what distinguishes this kind of study and research from what is customary today. The end of Lecture 4.